Hello, it's Paul D'Souza and Warren Giroux from Sightline Wealth Management here for another Sightline Conversation. Hello, Warren. How have you been?
Pretty good, thanks. And you?
Doing well. Thank you. Thank you. A lot has happened. I think probably news of the week or day has been Trump contracting the coronavirus. Maybe you want to begin with your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I was looking this morning on a website and they had a response of the Dow Jones response to presidential health shocks, and it goes back 100 years. And they're on this chart, they show what the Dow Jones, the impact on the Dow Jones, the day of the announcement, and how many days it took to recover. It's interesting, you know, it goes back when Wilson was infected with Spanish flu back in April 1919, the Dow dropped 1.5%, took 4 days to recover. This was the most surprising for me, was the Kennedy assassination back in 1963. The market fell 2.9% and took 4 days to recover. I thought, you know, it would have taken a lot more to recover off an over an assassination of a president. The longest period to recover was when Eisenhower had his heart attack in 1955. The market was down 10%. And it took 75 days to recover. And then Eisenhower had Crohn's disease. The market fell 6.5%, and it took 56 days to recover. But when he had his stroke in 1957, it was down only 2% and took 1 day to recover. Most of the impact of presidential health shocks were less than 1%, and it took about a day to recover. So last week when we saw the announcement came out about Trump and the coronavirus, we had a pretty significant decline in the averages. The S&P actually ended up falling 1%. That it started the day much greater than that. The Dow ended off just 0.5%. And if we take a look at what the markets are doing today, the S&P 500 and the Dow are both up about 1.4% as we're speaking at the moment. So we kind of expected to see some volatility as a result of that, thought it would be fairly negative. But in fact, the market seems to shrug off illnesses when it comes to the president, which is, I thought, a little surprising.
Yeah, I think the news has been that he's in good health. It's not, you know, he's not been hospitalized or not a ventilator. So possibly that could be it as well. I mean, last I read, he's probably due back in the office the next few days. So I handle that.
Yeah.
Well.
Okay.
Yeah. And what else? What's happening with unemployment figures? You know, something we track.
Yeah. The jobs number last week was about 837 first time unemployed, unemployment filings, but the analysts basically were sort of a little bit suspicious of the number because California announced that they had a 2-week pause in processing claims, so the number could be a little bit higher than that. The interesting thing, though, was continuing claims fell by over 980,000 on a seasonally adjusted number to about 11.8 million. And as a result, the unemployment rate actually fell to 7.9 versus 8.2. In the jobs front last week, it was kind of disappointing. We saw 661,000 new jobs, which was considerably less than what was anticipated. They were anticipating 800,000 new jobs. But when you look at the numbers, you break the numbers down, there was 877,000 new jobs in the private sector. State, I should say, teachers. It really hit the teaching profession, with teachers and state colleges losing a significant or had a significant number of jobs lost, and that's due to a lot of online classes. In addition to that, last week we saw some other numbers that were kind of like the PMI and the SMI numbers. They were a little bit weak. They were just slightly less than the previous numbers. For example, 5.2 for the PMI, and the previous month in August was 53.5. The IMS was manufacturing number was 55.4. They were expecting 56.4 and down from 56 in August. So these numbers, although not, I think they're a little bit weaker than most people expected, but they're not surprising given the fact that we've had a number of shutdowns. And also, you know, when we think back when we sort of reopened the economy a little bit, we had a significant snapback. And we saw, you know, these numbers were some of the highest numbers or changes that we'd seen in month to month over in a month to month or month over month basis. And it's not, I don't think, unusual or surprising to see it sort of slowing down a little bit. And I guess the other comment that I'd make regarding this is that most companies are growing a little more concerned about the sustainability of the economic disruption from the pandemic, and that's causing them to sort of pull their horns in a little bit regarding new plant equipment, although the order books are still fairly strong. It's giving them pause, especially given the fact that we have a stimulus situation. The stimulus package that's going through Congress has been stalled over the last little while, and it seems that the Democrats' package included some terms that the Republicans didn't like, and the Republicans have been holding up as a result of it. The Democrats have been pulling back a little bit from that, but still it's not enough to satisfy the Republicans. So I think on Friday, Pelosi came out and suggested she was going to do a targeted stimulus, which was for the airline industry, who they're expecting to lay off about 32,000 people, I believe. And I think, you know, there may not be a total stimulus package that we all would like to see, but we may have a targeted stimulus, which, like the airline industry, will take care of it, at least help in quite a few situations. So hopefully that comes to pass. So actually, Paul, that sort of gives me a segue into something that I wanted to ask you about. You know, with all the stimulus that we've had in the system, all this printing of money, the budget deficits and the long-term debt just gone through the roof. What's your take on it, and how does that focus in the, or how does that, what's the result sort of in the precious metal area or commodity area? What do you think that the impact's going to be?
You know, that's, I was just asked that actually for, there's an interview with the firm from Out West, and the question surrounded, you know, is now right time to buy gold? Is it too high? Should you wait for an entry point a little bit lower? And, you know, for those that don't own gold, I think you want to look to about a 5 to 10% allocation. And I would suggest that you enter in with half or a third of your position. And then if the price goes lower, maybe, you know, enter again and to make up your position. But ultimately, it really doesn't matter. If you, I spend quite a bit of time with my clients on before their first purchase of bullion, is that this is a generational hold. Their time horizon for this will be 30 to 40 to 50 years. And don't focus on the price. And I stress that the price will drive them, will cause them fits and anxiety, because it won't make sense. It'll go down when you think it's going up, and it may fall further. But ultimately, this is something that should make the foundation. If you're building a home, you're building the foundation with bricks of gold. And the financial assets, you think about everything else, is based on, you know, paper virtually, that will rest on top of that. And don't focus on the price. Focus on the number of ounces that you own. And in terms of stimulus, that is sort of a long answer to the question. I sometimes do this every once in a while. I looked at annual gold production is about 3,000 tons. And I believe, current spot price, that's about $188 billion of annual, the gold value annually. And I went on a website. If you go to usdebtclock.org, and I'm staring at the M2 money supply. And so I calculated that roughly, you know, how much was M2 was created in a minute, and then multiplied that out. And you get about $188 billion is created in about 16 days. And so what takes the world 1 year to extract that value in gold at 3,000 tons, it takes the U.S. 16 days to print. And so there in itself is one metric to understand, you know, the purchasing power and the wealth power of gold bullion, just because it can't be printed out of thin air. It represents real wealth. There's effort required to, you know, these companies going through a lot of effort to pull this out of the ground and create into investable gold. And so when you look at it that way, in terms of let's maybe go up slightly higher too, when you look at the amount of stimulus just this year, due to the COVID-19 crisis, estimates are around $6 to $8 trillion. Is that roughly right, Warren? Like six?
Yeah,
to eight?
Yeah. Yes. Yes. Yeah.
And so when you calculate the value of all the gold ever mined in the world, back to the envelope math, I think it's roughly, $16 trillion? I have to double check on this, but anywhere, call it from anywhere to $12 to $16 trillion. So if you think about that, since the beginning of the first ounce ever pulled out of the earth, and still, you know, most of that gold is still above ground, the U.S. created half that value in less than 9 months. So that's pretty astounding when you think of how, you know, people, the price is still where it's at. So I contend it'll probably be much higher, and you know, in the future, won't go exactly as planned or where you thought it would be, but it has so many attributes. It protects against monetary irresponsibility, fiscal imprudence, against financial disruptions in the, you know, in the finance or banking system. It protects purchasing power. It's a monetary asset, and we're in a debt-based fiat monetary experiment globally now since 1971. Nothing's, you know, gold. Since Nixon closed the gold window and the collapse of the Bretton Woods Agreement, there's now a massive experiment of, you know, backing dollars with debt instead of gold. The World Gold Council has a white paper on portfolio diversification with gold. It lowers the standard deviation. It increases returns. It's a non or a low correlated asset. I believe the Sharpe ratio is actually higher with a portfolio with gold than without it. I believe the Sortino ratio is higher with a portfolio with gold in it. So if I just urge, you know, investors to, I think when the gold community, you know, if, you know, I've been around it for many years now, investors will buy gold and then surround themselves with reading Zero Hedge and all of the macro, I'll say all of the news sites that, you know, has this, what I call the echo chamber. It's just individuals repeating, you know, the same things over and over again about why the reasons to own it. And, you know, investors are almost hoping for these events to occur to raise the price of their gold investment. And they're looking at, to me, that's more of a speculation mindset. I'm the opposite. I hold it as a wealth preservation mindset. I'm holding the gold. I hope it doesn't actually go up in price, because that means everything else is not doing so well. But if I do, I'm covered. It's much like house insurance. I buy house insurance. I hope my house doesn't burn down. But if it does, I'm covered. So it really is a mindset that I really stress for investors, is to buy it when you have your statement, when you open your statement and you see the price, disregard it. Concern yourself with all the other investments. And you know, just focus on the amount of ounces you own and the purchasing power that you own. Warren, let me ask you, how's this? I was just explaining this to someone. In 1971, do you recall what you paid for a house, or maybe your father at that time, roughly in your area where you live? Maybe where did you live in 1971? What state or a province? And what was the average price of a house?
Well, I actually lived in Virginia at the time, and the average price of a reasonable house back then was, I think, in the neighborhood of about $30,000 to $35,000 where we were.
Are you kidding me?
In the southern part of Virginia.
Yeah. That's perfect. Perfect. So 1971, when Nixon closed the gold window, August 15th, actually, August, the price was $35 an ounce. So if you think it took divide your $35,000 by 35, took 1,000 ounces of gold to purchase that house. Okay, so what's the spot price of gold today? Is it 19?
About 1913, I think.
Okay, so 1913 US times 1,000 ounces, $1,913. Do you think the price of that home in today's is priced at that? $1 million?
I know it's not. I know it's, not. It's definitely not in that area. Not even close.
What do you think it is? Just, I know
it's not. I think it's probably in the $300,000, $350,000, maybe $400,000, that same house.
Okay, there you go. So you can see the substantial difference and the wealth. This is what I mean about wealth preservation. So it keeps one's standard of living in terms of, that's how I measure gold, is in that purchasing power. I can still purchase an average price home. In fact, I could probably buy 4 average price homes now in that part of Virginia you were at with the gold ounces. So I think speculators look at the price and concern themselves about, is it too high, is it too low? Probably for mining stocks, that's very well, it's obviously you need to do that. But with bullion, do not look at the price and just focus on the number of ounces, put it aside and literally don't worry about it. I focus on what's happening else with the other investments, what's happening with our managers, looking for new managers, monitoring our current ones, you know, everything that you do, you know, like the due diligence, the monitoring, the oversight. With gold bullion, it's one of the few set and forget strategies. Mind you, when you're purchasing bullion, you must be 100% clear that you actually own bullion. It's not a paper proxy. It's not that there's actually physical gold backing it and not a promise of gold or some derivative. So
that was what I was going to ask, Paul. You don't believe in paper gold. You believe in actually owning the ounces. So if you were to own the ounces, where would you go to buy them for our listeners?
Well, first of all, so I don't believe in paper gold because I don't choose to speculate in it. And if I wanted to speculate, sure, I would buy paper gold. I would buy, you know, an ETF or maybe call options on it. I don't care if I, you know, options are backed by physical. There's a few ETFs, there's a few other investments, even bank certificates are not backed by gold. And that's fine if you're a speculator, but just go, you know, enter this trade full, you know, understanding full well that it's not gold. You're just speculating on the price movement. As an investor, you want to have an open-end mutual fund trust that owns physical gold. You have to look at the fine print. You have to look at the prospectus. Is it allocated? You know, where is it held? So all of that matters. That there's few things or events or circumstances that can come between you and your bullion. I know many investors want to, and I know we use, you know, the closed-end fund, the Sprott closed-end fund, and the 9-point gold bullion mutual fund, both excellent choices, and, you know, allocated segregated bullion and insured, held at the mint. And, some individuals wish to buy coins and store it at home. Again, that's I don't understand that mentality. It's a pirate mentality. Individuals want to, store their portable wealth almost in some kind of calamity that, you know, they can, you know, use it to barter for things, I suppose. I only hold, or I suggest anyone hold, as much as they're willing to lose in terms of someone, you know, someone finds out or your house gets, broken into and you don't mind losing that. It's not insured. It's not insurable, I should say. So hold a few coins if it makes you happy, if you like to look at it. But, given some of the sizes investors' portfolios, if you have a $1 million portfolio with a 10% allocation, how comfortable would you feel having $100,000 in gold in your home?
Well, the other thing too, Paul, in that regard is as we know, it's becoming increasingly hard to actually transport gold. I mean, just think about it. When you get on a plane and you go to a foreign country, many countries have limits as to how much cash they allow you to bring in. I've heard numerous stories of people trying to go in Europe in particular, trying to cross borders with gold and have been stopped and had the gold confiscated. So it's not as portable as it once was many years ago. It made sense probably to have physical gold where you could actually transport your wealth quite easily. But in today's environment, when you get on a plane or you cross a border, there's chances are that it could be confiscated just because there are limitations as to what you can take. I mean, after all, they're limiting cash, right? Right. If you have more than $10,000, they ask you if you have more than $10,000 on you when you travel today and across an international border. So it's, yeah, I hear what you're saying. It makes more sense to have a, like you say, a trust that actually has the physical gold. So it shows up on your statements and feel comfortable that way. So yeah. Anyway, do you have any other thoughts on that, on precious metals or commodities in general?
Many, but probably a lack of time. We don't want to go on, maybe in future conversations, we can, you know, kind of touch on parts of it. But just on that point to us, so do you have any, you know, $10,000 worth of cash? Well, doesn't that illustrate that gold is a currency? If they're asking for gold, if that's so, it, you know, individuals will denigrate gold, or you know, media will denigrate gold, saying it's a worthless rock. Then why is it important to ask if you're carrying this worthless rock with you? Right? Going back to 1971, if it was a worthless rock, why did Nixon close the gold window? Why was it more important for him to default on with the Bretton Woods Agreement to actually, tear that up, because holding on to his gold was more important? Because as you know, the U.S. is creating, you know, due to stagflation, they were creating more money and not backing it by the appropriate amount of gold. It's supposed to be 1/35th of an ounce. One thirty-fifth of an ounce for every dollar. And when that didn't happen, individuals or other countries were literally saying, here's our US dollars, give us back our gold, or give, I want to trade this in for gold. So about 10,000 tons actually left leading up to 1971. So enough was enough. Nixon, and this is what I think, you know, those who don't understand or maybe denigrate gold don't maybe should appreciate, is that, you know, if gold was useless, why did Nixon basically default on that in order to keep the gold from leaving? So fast forward to, you know, 2020, we're still talking about it. Again, I think any last closing thoughts on it, just don't look at it as an investment. Look at that as a core, as an asset that you're going to hold for a very, very long time.
Yeah, in case of an emergency, you may need it for some reason, or actually it offsets your portfolio. It gives you, essentially it's a hedge against an economic crisis.
It goes on, like, you know, saying earlier in the call, it's also a protection against negative real interest rates. It's a portfolio diversifier. It's stability in the monetary system. We're an experiment. I mean, let's just remind everyone. It's the first time, you know, this is, what are we now? Going on a 50-year experiment. Next year will mark 50 years from the gold standard being ceased, or the convertibility of dollars into gold. 50-year experiment. And look what happened in that 50 years. From the value of your house in Virginia to today versus the purchasing power of the gold. So yeah. We don't know how this will end. We have an idea. I mean, if you look at failed, you know, all currency crises and failed fiat currencies in history, history's littered with it. There's never been a successful currency. And what I mean successful, it's preserved purchasing power. They've all, now it's very difficult to ascertain because of the bubble we're having when you, this, you know, this is an asset bubble as well. Art and collectible cars and homes and, you know, things are all being bid up with low interest rates and excess stimulus. So there's this illusion, but unfortunately, you know, that doesn't, it's different for every investor. It's different for every person. It's very personal, depending on some are profiting wildly on this and others are very hard, hit. You remember when you were growing up, you know, one parent worked. The other stayed home. typically today you need both an average person, average family needs both parents working, and sometimes that's not enough to keep up with the standard of living.
Yes. Yeah. So very stressful times for a lot of people, and certainly the traditional ways of investing or thinking of investing have somewhat been turned on their head as a result of the monetary policies of central banks globally, as you mentioned, with extremely low in a lot of cases in Europe and even Japan, we have zero interest rates, and it's been with us for quite some time and hasn't really spurred the inflation that they thought it would, or actually spurred spending. So the monetary policy certainly caused a lot of major distortions in our marketplace and bubbles, right, as you mentioned.
Now, having said this, you know, when people hear this, they tend to think, oh my gosh, that doesn't sound great. Let me put, you know, most of my money in gold. That's not what we're saying here whatsoever.
No.
There's also the investment winds are always blowing. It's just as, you know, the job and your role of an advisor and asset allocator is to adjust the sales according to the direction of those winds. And so there's other asset classes which do, you know, very well given the various economic environments. Right. So we have growth, low growth, low inflation, high inflation, interest rates. So there's all this plays into various assets. And as our listeners know, maybe you can speak to this too, the private debt that we've been allocated to the last 10 years, senior secured private debt spending.
Yeah, that I was going to mention that we, you know, as asset allocators, that's one of the things that we've tried to do over the last several years, been trying to find assets that have lower correlation with each other, that move independently of each other. And that's been a real challenge. And one of those areas, especially when we look at fixed income, for example, with, zero interest rates, and the Fed chairman Powell came out a couple of weeks ago and basically said, we're going to leave interest rates low for at least 2 years. And even if inflation goes over their target of 2%, they're looking at an average inflation rate now. Which I think is going to cause some heartache if inflation accelerates. But again, you know, we could also see inflation rise because of demand, but because people all of a sudden shortage of supply, and inflation in dollars because people don't have confidence in currencies. We could see inflation that way, but. One of the hardest things we've had with the low interest rates is how do we generate income? So that's taken us to the private debt space. And, right. You know, a lot of the – when you look at the private debt space and you look at the due diligence that's being completed by these lenders on regarding the borrowers and the people that are who want the money or need the money for their businesses, it's quite extensive. It's not like – you know, loan sharking, where they're just handing money out willy-nilly. There's a quite detailed process to go through regarding due diligence and also personal guarantees. A lot of these loans are asset-backed. Some are enterprise-backed. So there's a lot of security there. And relative to, say, a corporate bond, in today's market, sometimes we have corporate bonds being issued. And certainly this year, we've seen enormous corporate bond issuance as a result of COVID. And the interest rates are very low, and companies are using the markets to actually shore up their balance sheets and to try to carry them through until, you know, they're back to production and earning money again. So we've seen a lot of issuance, and these bonds are they're not backed by anything. They're just, you know, backed by air, faith and credit, or guarantee of the company, and whereas the private debt that we've been involved in, they're asset-backed, enterprise value-backed, they're personal guarantees, covenants, and so forth and so on, very, very strict. So it's not like the Wild West by any stretch of the imagination, and that has certainly helped our portfolios. And we've also looked at other strategies within the equity space, as you well know, and merger arb and SPACs and so forth and so on, that have also been able to help stabilize our portfolios through this difficult period. And it's not been just because we had COVID. This has been going on now. We've been in this environment now for, you know, many years since really, I guess you could say, I look back at the tech bubble and say that's when, you know, basically central banks decided that they want to try to put an end to the business cycle and try to keep the party going forever. created the real estate bubble in 2007 and 8, 9. And then since then, you know, we had the most tepid recovery during the Obama years into the Trump years. And now we have COVID. So this period of difficulty has been with us for quite some time. And it looks like it's going to be with us for the foreseeable future, the way things are going right now, given central bank and monetary policies and so forth. But while you were talking, Paul, sort of taking us back a little bit, I looked at the U.S. debt clock, and the U.S. national debt is just over $27 trillion. Isn't that incredible that in a period of 12 to 13 years, the Obama years and now the Trump years, that we've seen such an explosion in the debt? And of course, it's continuing to accelerate, you know, as we go through this crisis, and we need to have federal spending to sort of help balance the monetary stimulus. It's just absolutely incredible. We're heading for some difficult waters.
And that's literally the tip of the iceberg. It's such a such an overused analogy, but if you look at total U.S. debt and you look at unfunded liabilities such as Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, look at the unfunded liabilities, the bottom right hand side, $154 trillion.
Yep, that's right.
Okay, so it's oftenly said is, how is the answer to a problem of too much debt is get further into debt? And this is literally, they're literally maxing. You know, have you heard thinking about this? Congress, remember, used to have when the debt ceiling was reached, they used to, you know, go away for 3-4 days and talk about it and then increase the debt ceiling. Do they even bother with that anymore? Do they even bother? It's just like, you know what? Meeting over, meeting canceled indefinitely because they're not. It's an absolute joke.
You know what? Funny you mentioned that. I haven't heard of it. I think as last I recurred, they were going to basically let it be a revolving sort of debt limit. Right. So as they needed it, they just let it keep on climbing.
That's right.
This whole experiment with Keynesian economics, you know, the academics have said that we're supposed to behave in a certain way. In other words, low interest rates means we should stimulate the economy. And they also, theorists believe that in good times, we should pay down debt. We should cut back on social programs. But because of we're being elected every 4 years or every 6 years or every 2 years or in the U.S. and 4 years as president, they just keep promising more and more benefits.
Yeah.
And it just keeps accelerating this debt without ever paying it back. And, you know, you need a reset. And it looks like, you know, we're going to have it. Who knows when, what the trigger is going to be. But certainly COVID has done some irreparable damage to funding ratios.
Austerity measures hurt.
Who knows?
Austerity measures hurt. It's very painful. I feel like, I don't see this reversing in a meaningful way over time. I mean, we have discussed this. The way out of this is it's a stealth. It's a stealth tax and confiscation of wealth is financial repression. We've discussed this in, you know, two or three of our past calls. That is a way to reduce the debt. However, it confiscates the purchasing power of individuals, and so hence you have to stay ahead of the real inflation rate, not the one that's sort of a headline rate, which has been changed over many, many years. Yeah. And so when you look at and I think individuals can feel it. Some individuals, you know, some people are doing extremely well and they're out earning, they're outpacing inflation, but those that are, say, in a fixed income, they feel it the most. And I think that's where you and I talk about a lot, is, helping individuals to to navigate this investment waters, given historically low interest rates, low yields, and investors are moving towards higher, riskier assets in search of, yield. And I think it's actually a travesty, because they can ill afford to do it. Can't go back to work to re-earn what they lost. So it's quite treacherous. And I think, you need a skilled asset allocator to manage what's, the waters that we're headed into, or we're in right now and headed to.
Oh, definitely. I couldn't agree more.
Hey, Warren, I think that's good for time. Thanks for...
Okay.
Thank you. And until we speak again, take care.
Very good. Thank you. You
All
as
right.
well.
Okay. Bye-bye. Bye now.